He started here. He is here. No one knows New York better. Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
I like marijuana, you like marijuana, we like marijuana too. Marijuana.
This is subtle.
I know there's a lot going on.
I like marijuana, you like marijuana.
But remembering particularly that streak in the early part of February where we went 12 days without a single murder in New York. And yet, by the time the month had tolled, there were 18 homicides in the big city in February alone. That is up 50% from the 12 shootings the year before in 2014. It is an undeniable spike in homicides. And the commissioner blames it on pot. Is that right?
Here he is, yeah.
The seemingly innocent drug that's being legalized around the country. In this city, people are killing each other over marijuana more so than anything having to do with what we dealt with in the 80s and 90s with heroin and cocaine.
I mean, this is incredibly instructive. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the police commissioner, Bill Bratton of the great city of New York, telling us that more people are being killed, these pot dealers are being killed by their rivals and by thieves, than were being killed by rivals and thieves dealing heroin back in the 80s, the bad old days. Tell me true. Isn't the best, most logical solution to this problem to legalize, to regulate, to tax marijuana, as Colorado and Washington are doing successfully, and the District of Columbia is attempting to do, Washington, D.C.? It is, in the president's own words, in the words of every expert, less harmful pot is than alcohol or prescription drugs. End pot prohibition now, or we will continue to suffer the consequences. And now this is scumbags killing scumbags. But I'm telling you, innocent bystanders are going to be caught up in this violence. There's too much money to be made. The lead this morning, though, is not about pot and it's not about homicide in the city. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu is now 51 minutes away from making his historic mistake. I know many of you disagree with me on this. I'd love to hear from you at 866-Geraldo. But I believe the prime minister, with the aid and consent of the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, is on the verge of reducing American-Israeli relations to just another partisan talking point. We will, of course, here on 77 WABC, have live coverage of his speech at the top of the next hour, and we will debate it. But this was a self-inflicted wound, an unnecessary controversy that really pulled into the partisan morass what had been the sacred Israeli-American relationship. This was John Boehner and the House Republicans trying to stick it in the eye of the president on this whole issue of Iran getting nuclear weapons. It's not even about Iran getting nuclear weapons. This is the right wing of the Republican Party and the right wing of the Israeli political scene deciding that they didn't like the negotiations with Iran. They didn't like any moderation when it comes to dealing with Iran, for all the historic reasons, and Iran is the prime architect of terrorism around the country, around the world, which I think is BS, by the way. They have decided to drag the prime minister here to make a campaign speech before the Congress of the United States. And as of right now, I don't know. Now we have Charlie Rangel went soft. But as of right now, almost one in four Democrats will be boycotting the speech at 11 o'clock by the prime minister. At least 55 Democrats, 8 senators, and 47 House members. But I understand, Noam Layden, that our friend Charlie Rangel, the longtime Harlem congressman, has chickened out.
I mean, last moment. Yesterday, when reporters were talking to him, he said he had a previous engagement at Gracie Mansion. And they asked him what it was. He didn't detail what it was. But then this morning, there he was in D.C. saying he was going to be there. He's going to be in Congress.
So now he will be there. It is an act of courage, sadly, in this country to defy the Israel right or wrong lobby. You've got to go with the program. And if you don't go with the program, you get punished financially and other ways. It's a sad thing, but we see now that Senator Al Franken will not be attending what he calls a partisan spectacle. I agree. Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is shot up to be at least the second most powerful Democrat in the Senate of the United States, she will not be attending. She said it's unfortunate that Speaker Boehner's actions on the eve of a national election in Israel have made Tuesday's event more political and less helpful for addressing the crucial issue of nuclear non-proliferation and the safety of our most important ally in the Middle East. Actually, I thought that Charlie Rangel said something very interesting, Noam, when he said just an hour ago, less, in announcing that he will attend, after all, the speech. He said the most farcical notion of this being Israel's existential threat, Iran and nuclear weapons, is that isn't it also an existential threat to the United States of America, to the world? This isn't just about a tiny country that we hold near and dear, the Jewish state. A nuclear weapon on a country the size of Rhode Island? This would be a declaration of war against the world. It is preposterous to make it just Israel's problem. It is not just Israel's problem. And yet you would think, with all of the attention being paid this visit, that what Bibi Netanyahu, at least the way they are attempting to package it, is attempting to do here, is prevent the new Neville Chamberlain, the new compromiser, the new peace at any price action by the President of the United States to give up the security of Israel and the free world, the world indeed. Because of what? What is Obama getting? Neville Chamberlain got peace in our time with Adolf Hitler when he gave up Czechoslovakia. What is Obama getting, supposedly, for this capitulation? And what is very, very deeply troubling to many people is Bibi Netanyahu, in his speech, going to give away secrets in terms of this negotiation? Remember, this is a negotiation, these nuclear non-proliferation talks going on in Geneva, Switzerland, not just between the United States and Iran. You have Russia involved, you have China involved, you have Germany involved, you have the United Kingdom involved. Britain is one of them, aren't they?
I think so, yeah.
And so now we're going to tell tales out of school to score cheap political points. And speaking of that, and I just want to give you a heads up that Peter Baker, the New York Times White House correspondent, will be joining us at the bottom of the hour to give us a real insider's assessment of what's going on. But this is very important. And you talk about this becoming politics, like the whole funding, remember, of the Department of Homeland Security, and John Boehner and the Republicans tried to stop that unless the President of the United States would take his immigration executive action off the table or just change his mind about it. I mean, this stinks, this political partisan spectacle, in Franken's words. Can't we just conduct the business of the United States in a way that is above this backbiting, backstabbing? Is Washington like just another celebrity apprentice? We've got so much going on here. 866-HERALDO. I'd love to hear from you. We will be back with much more on this historic day after this.
The sound of the city, Geraldo, where New York comes to talk. 77 WABC.
If, in fact, we are trying to finalize a deal, why not wait to see, A, is there actually going to be a deal? Can Iran accept the terms that we're laying out? That if, in fact, a deal is arrived at, that it's going to be a deal that is most likely to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
So that's the president complaining about Bibi kind of jumping the gun here and not allowing the negotiations to play out. The president of the United States very concerned now that what the prime minister of Israel is doing is sabotaging any chance of a compromise here. 37 minutes, less than 37 minutes before Bibi is introduced. As Peter Baker, the White House correspondent for The Times, writes, this is by far the most anticipated speech by a foreign leader in many years. Bibi now heading to Capitol Hill will tell you he has arrived. He's arrived now at the Capitol. He's ready to issue this high-profile warning. So what do you think about it? Let's get as many calls in as we can. Peter Baker joining us, the White House correspondent at the bottom of the hour from Brooklyn. Avi, what's up, Avi?
Good morning, Geraldo. First of all, you sound much calmer today. I guess you're excited.
I only had one coffee, Avi.
Okay. Anyway, yesterday you were a little bit offended or disappointed that people were mentioning the Holocaust, and this could... Let me tell you, but go ahead. Let me tell you something. Can you imagine if before the Holocaust, a world leader or a Jewish leader could have gotten up and told the world what's going on in Europe and try to prevent a Holocaust from happening? Anybody would have given that speech. Now, I'm not saying that what's going on now is on the level of a Holocaust, but the fact is that Iran wants to destroy...
But Avi, listen, my uncle Phil Langer, I remember as kids we used to see his tattoo from Auschwitz. He's a butcher in Long Island.
Let me finish.
And he used to tell the stories, and we used to watch with our jaws agape. You know, we just could not believe that people could do that to other people. And as Jewish kids, obviously you feel the ominous nature of that. What is there about this that remotely compares to that? You're not talking about a desire to exterminate a race of people. You're talking about a nation that wants to develop what other nations have, a nuclear weapon. We object to it because this is a radical state, and they have behaved erratically in the past, and we worry that they'll be like another Pakistan, which we have nightmares, wet sweats about. This has nothing to do with Jews. This has to do with Persian, with Iranians and their nuclear ambition. Why just Jews? Why aren't Christians worried? Why aren't Buddhists worried and Hindus? Well, they are. That's my point. This is not about the Jews.
But who's the first one on the list?
Where is it? How's he going to hit? Are they going to hit Israel with what?
With a bomb.
Avi, I love you, man, but I think that it's very unfair to try to couch this in the terms of that historic sin against humanity. In Brooklyn, Brenda. Hi, Brenda.
Hi. This is an attempt by Obama to have something to spin for his poor historical record. There is no compromise dealing with Iran.
But why not? We compromise with everybody. I mean, don't you? Nobody gets everything they want.
Do not like our culture. It is not about anything else. We show them a culture that...
Or let me ask you this, Brenda. Who do you fear worst, Iran or ISIS?
Both. You can't compare.
Well, I worry about ISIS a lot more than I worry about Iran. Here's Steve on Long Island. Hey, Steve.
Hey, what's going on, Geraldo?
I don't know. I'm trying to tell you where I stand. I'm not having much luck, but good.
Geraldo, I got to tell you, I'm very, very surprised at your position on this. I'll tell you why. As an American, and as someone who voted Democrat and has nothing to do with Israel, you know, we have a political system that's, you know, there's a separation of powers. And you know, the president, you know, even though maybe it's protocol, but the speaker can do what he wants, and we pride ourselves in the speech. And, you know, it seems like as if President Obama only respects freedom of speech when it works for him. And if he wants, and second of all, I want to know, I want to hear what he has to say. I don't believe Obama at
all. I want to hear what he has to say, too, but why couldn't he have said it at AIPAC yesterday, which was an appropriate venue? And he could have had just as big an audience. He has to go to the halls of the Capitol, uninvited by the White House. I mean, I just don't see it.
Araldo, that's the point. He doesn't need to be invited by the White House.
He has to. I think that for a foreign leader, we're going to have various factions in the Congress of the United States with their own foreign policy. Is that what you want, Steve? You want the next one's going to invite? Let's have the leader from Cameroon. Let's have the leader from Thailand. Let's have the leader they're going to make their own. Come on, you can't do it that way, man. What? You just can't do it that way. All right, here is Tony in New Jersey. What's up, Tony?
Hey, how you doing?
Good, man.
Yeah, listen, I'm a former Marine. I'm from Cliffside. My friend lives near, but that's beside the point. I just want to tell you.
Are you a neighbor of mine? But go ahead, and thank you for your service.
I'm a veteran of the VFW in Fort Lee up here. And everybody salutes you. Let me tell you, the government people, if you didn't serve or haven't been in the foreign land, they don't have a clue what's going on. I used to guard Reagan. There'll never be a bomb like Thatcher and Reagan again. Our government's it's falling apart. It's a shame. I did 3 tours of combat. I'm a Desert Storm veteran. I was the first one into Kuwait. But everybody who's breaking me off, I'm just saying, hey, we salute you. You've been in the foreign land.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you, brother. I appreciate that.
We want to invite you up to the VFW.
Well, invite me. I'm like 10 feet away. Just invite me.
Yeah, I know. I'm not going to say.
Just stick a letter in my mailbox. I'll come. I promise.
Yeah, one of the places. Anyway, it's just confidential. But listen, there's history there. We got World War II veterans that the government disgusts us because they got to work with the president. No one's working it. The government's just saying that's everything. Bruce, we salute you, buddy.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for your service. Thank you very much. I'll see you soon. Thank you. All right. Yeah, I got a good one from a neighbor. Some help from the Marines. The Marines have landed in Fort Lee and Edgewater. Noam's got the news now.
From New York, for New York, live, local, on it. Geraldo, 77 WABC, where New York comes to talk.
He's got the front page story running right now on the New York Times website. The headline, Netanyahu, amid tensions, prepares to deliver speech to Congress on Iran. He's going to give a warning, writes Peter Baker, the White House correspondent for the New York Times, warning these negotiations going on right now with Iran. United States-Israeli relations roiled by this. Peter Baker joins us live right now. Do you remember, Peter, welcome? Have you remember something like this ever happening? I mean, it seems unprecedented to me.
It's pretty unusual. We were trying to rack our brains yesterday for another example when a foreign leader would come to Congress to so sort of frontally confront a president. And it's hard to think of a parallel. The only thing anybody could come up with yesterday was remembering when the Congress invited Douglas MacArthur after Harry Truman fired him to come to Congress and give an address to a joint session. Of course, that wasn't a foreign leader, a different context. But it's hard to think of a real parallel here.
You're going back to 1950, 1951. That's going way, way back. Can you tell me, we see now that Charlie Rangel, New York's congressman, will be attending. What kind of pressure has been exerted on those boycotting today's address that they better, watch their backs or whatever?
Well, I think you're getting cross currents, right, from different directions. On the one hand, if you're a Democrat, you want to support your president. You're probably miffed that Speaker Boehner has issued this invitation without consulting the White House. At the same time, you know, most of them support Israel pretty strongly. Some of them have Jewish constituents who are watching to make sure that they stick by Israel, and they don't want Israel to become a partisan issue in which one party seems to be more supportive than the other.
What about, surprising defections like Abe Foxman? I've known him for a long time. The national director of the Anti-Defamation League is usually an Israel right or wrong guy. He's saying the speech is wrong. What motivated people like Foxman to look at Bibi's address to Congress in a way that is so negative?
Yeah, I talked with him yesterday, too, and I think that he feels that it was counterproductive, that it became a distraction from the actual issue, and the actual issue is whether Iran should have a nuclear weapon and how to stop it, and that because this has become so polarized, it was counterproductive. He, at the same time, he felt that Netanyahu did a pretty good job yesterday when he addressed AIPAC, that's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, in trying to tone down at least some of the personal nature of the rhetoric, and that he hoped that his Foxman hoped that that might begin to, you know, get rid of some of the extra stuff and focus on the real, what he feels is the real issue.
So do you think the, in terms of the boycott, what will, if anything, be the lasting impact of this kind of confrontation between, you know, congressional Democrats, the Obama administration, and Bibi Netanyahu in Israel?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I think that this has raised the temperature, raised the stakes, certainly for this Iran deal that the president's trying to cut as early as this month. He wants to come up with a deal that limits Iran's potential for perhaps creating a nuclear weapon over a 10-year period. Netanyahu's going to say it's not good enough. We can't trust them, that they've cheated before. And, you know, at this point, it's going to make it harder, I think, for President Obama, if he even comes to a deal with Iran, to sell it back at home, because a lot of critics who might have been skeptical anyway will now look at what Netanyahu said and say, well, see, the man who has to live with it in the neighborhood thinks it's not good enough. I'm on his side.
Well, Peter Baker, White House correspondent for The New York Times, is our guest. We're waiting Bibi Netanyahu's historic address, very controversial address, to the Congress of the United States in less than 20 minutes. And normally this will happen right at the top of the hour.
They're telling us a hard time, 11 o'clock.
All right, yeah. So Peter, you're writing here in your article today that the President of the United States, a half hour after Bibi's begins his address, will have this conference call with all European leaders about the negotiations. But I want to go back to the point you just raised. Will, if they make a deal with Iran, will that be considered a treaty that needs the advice and consent of the Senate of the United States? Will he then have to sell it in terms of a vote by the Congress?
Well, it's not a treaty, so it won't require Senate confirmation or Senate ratification, which would be a two-thirds vote in the Senate. But in order to lift all of the different sanctions that Iran would like to have lifted as part of this agreement, Congress would have a say in that. Congress imposed some of these sanctions itself. Some of them were imposed by the president. He can waive them. But to have a permanent change in that would require Congress to act, and that would be both houses, at least a majority vote.
And so where are we going? What are the chances the president's going to be able to sell a deal if he makes a deal?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think what he's saying is wait to see what it actually says, and then we can discuss it. But it's hard to imagine with the Republican Congress and the issue becoming quite as polarized as it has been, it's hard to see a Congress buying into anything that doesn't seem tough enough. And of course, Netanyahu will be drawing a line, in effect, for what seems tough enough.
I know you're down Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol, but you have the House Speaker, John Boehner, caving on the funding of the Department of Homeland Security. Now they're going to have a clean bill that doesn't require, the exercising of these restrictions or immigration. So Boehner now, he invites Bibi, he gets in all that kind of controversy. He has to backtrack on the Department of Homeland Security. What happens to the Speaker of the House now?
Well, obviously, it's a kind of embarrassing walk back for him. He's had a hard time managing his own caucus in the last few days. He's admitted that it hasn't been very much fun for him. Though he didn't expect Friday's vote to go the way it did, and he's kind of left holding the bag here. We'll see how this plays out in the next few days. There's been talk about whether conservatives might try to mount yet another effort to replace him. It's hard to imagine they have the votes for that, but it creates a very tense and difficult time, I think, for the Speaker who's trying to start out a new Congress on a new footing.
It's a tense and difficult time for the Speaker. All right, in terms of, using Humphrey Bogart and the Hill of Beans, a cliche, when this is all, when Bibi makes this speech and he delivers the speech and he goes home, what's the lasting impact of this?
Well, I mean, there could be three different places, right? First, in Israel itself, where he's facing an election in 2 weeks. Does this help him or hurt him? Does it appeal to his core constituency enough to get him another term? Here, the other question is in Geneva. Does it change the dynamics of the talks? Does it, do the Iranians look at this and one way or the other? And here in Washington, does it give the president, a harder time in making that negotiation with so much consternation in his backyard?
All right, those are the questions. You got any answers? We'll call you back.
Well, I think that's right. Look, I think the chances of a deal that, first of all, both sides would agree to, and then second of all, Congress agreed to, that's less than 50-50, I'd say most people say.
All right, Peter Baker, White House correspondent, New York Times. Appreciate it, Peter. Thank you, man.
Have a great day.
So there's a smart guy with a fair assessment of what's going on. Let's go back to what he said. And I think this is, ironically, the least interesting part of this. I mean, in reality, let's talk amongst ourselves. In reality, the least interesting part of this is the substance of it, whether or not there's going to be a deal with Iran over nuclear weapons. Because I think most people believe that there will ultimately be a deal. Because the alternative to a deal is military action against Iran, a major country with a major armed force, another war in the Middle East. That's not going to happen. I almost guarantee you that that's not going to happen under any circumstances. Israel will not launch a preemptive unilateral strike. How's an Israeli aircraft, for instance, going to get from Israel to Iran? It has to cross over Iraq, for one, maybe Saudi Arabia, Jordan. So an Israeli aircraft, it's one thing when they bombed the nuclear reactor in Iraq. Iraq was right there. It was Saddam Hussein. Everybody hated him. So they took out the Iraqi reactor and I remember doing great stories extolling the virtue of that raid, that unilateral raid. We all applauded it. This is a way different situation now. There would be multiple countries involved. The Israeli Air Force would have a daunting task of getting all the way to Iraq. It's, as far as I remember, it's 400-500 miles at least over hostile territory just to get to the target, at least 500 miles. And over these multiple countries, and then they're going to bomb, then they got to get the aircraft back. What are the Americans going to do? We have all the radar there. What are the Iraqis, to the extent they can do anything? What are the Saudis going to say? I don't think that that's going to happen. I think that ultimately there will be a deal. But the bottom line is, and this is the thing that is what troubles me the most, isn't about Iran and nukes. It's about Israel and America. What happens now as we go forward? I mean, nobody has talked about the Israeli-Palestinian situation. We know that the Israelis have cut off funding for the Palestinian Authority because the Palestinian Authority went to the International Court of Justice and filed a war crimes charge against Israel because of what happened in Gaza last summer. You know, there's a lot of tumult and trouble there. And the tragedy to me, the real bottom line tragedy of all this is it lessens our focus on ISIS. ISIS is the true existential threat. Iran developing nuclear weapons, like Pakistan has nuclear weapons and North Korea has nuclear weapons. The world will deal with Iran eventually. This is the now. You have ISIS now. And did you read that? They fed one of the mothers.
Yeah, I don't think that was true, by the way.
A meal. But I thought it, the thing isn't that they just cannibalized the child and fed it to the mother. The real bottom line is that it could be true because right. They are such savages and they have real power and they sit astride so much oil. They are in a position where they are disrupting life in so many different nations already. You have crazy people being motivated by their social media. That is, to me, the real problem with what Bibi has done is take the focus off the true enemy of Israel and America and the free world, the peaceful civilization, indeed, ISIS. That is what I find deeply troubling. It's 48 minutes after. We are 12 minutes from this historic speech. I will get to all of your calls eventually. I'll take a bunch of them right after this quick break. Then we'll have Bibi's speech, and then we'll talk for the rest of the morning, and we'll all be responding. And I appreciate the fact that you are so engaged, and I'll get to you. Please be patient.
Geraldo, live, local. Today's most important New York stories, only on 77 WABC.
All right, 5 minutes now. 5 minutes. Welcome back, 77 WABC.
Hey, you know what?
Yes, sir.
we have somebody inside the gallery in Washington who's going to see Bibi Netanyahu live. And it just happens to be the rabbi of my synagogue in Hoboken, the Chabad synagogue in Hoboken. And it's Rabbi Moshe Shapiro. And he got, you know, each congressperson gets one ticket to bring somebody to Congress with them to watch us. And Moshe was able to pull off this ticket, and he's on the phone with us.
Rabbi, hello. Noam's rabbi. How are you, Rabbi? Hello?
Is he not there?
Not there?
Oh. What an introduction, and he's not there.
What a big intro. Find the rabbi for me. Find the rabbi. In the meantime, Dan in New Jersey. What's up, Dan?
Hi, Geraldo. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I think what the president, the relationship he has with Congress, literally is his chickens coming home to roost. Let me explain why.
Sure.
After the last election, he didn't say the people have spoken, let's work together to help the country. He said, I have a pen to veto, I have a phone for executive action, and now I'm going to represent the two-thirds of the people who didn't vote, which is an unusual thing because I think we elect our politicians by the vote. You know, if you're going to represent the people who don't vote, I think it's almost a violation of your job.
So I don't like that either. I think voting should be mandatory, tell you the truth. I think you should, if you don't vote, you get fined $100.
I agree. I think this opportunity, but I agree with you. This is just the Republicans sticking it in his eye because they can.
I agree. Excellent analysis, Dan. Thank you very much. Can I squeeze one more in? Quick. All right, Mark, quick. You got 15 seconds. Hurry.
Okay, there's no talk that Israel has 300 nuclear weapons. Former Secretary of State, I can't think of his name, but it's a well-known fact. How come the media doesn't talk about Israel's illegal nuclear arsenal? I mean, it pretends that...
I saw Golda's Balcony. You ever see that play?
No.
They almost used the nuclear... Thank you. Their nuclear weapon in the 1973 war when they feared they were going to lose.
Introduction, so we'll wait until the Prime Minister actually walks out to the podium. So what will he say today? He's going to, of course, talk about this potential deal between the United States and Iran on nukes. But we haven't got any speech ahead of time. Normally, when there's big speeches like this, the text we get it maybe 10, 20, 30 minutes before the world leader or the president or some lawmaker walks out. In this case, we have no idea. There's no text of what the Prime Minister will say, so it'll be a surprise to us as it will be to you. 53 seats, that's the number we're being told, will be empty in the chambers, in the gallery. Those are all Democrats who have opted out of the speech, angry that House Speaker John Boehner invited the Prime Minister without letting the White House know firsthand. And so 53 Democrats, one of them being a local New York Congressman Gregory Meeks from Brooklyn, will not be in the chambers. Yvette. She's in there now. We also, Charlie Rangel had said he was going to opt out, but he is now also in the chamber. We've seen him. So it's all, of course, this speech is against the backdrop back home for Bibi Netanyahu of his election. Big election going on in Israel 2 weeks from now. The speech will play there, but with a 5-minute delay for Israelis, which is awfully interesting because it's the height of campaign season there. So they want to watch to make sure that he doesn't get some sort of strange advantage back home. The way they handle Israeli campaigning ahead of an election there, usually just the week before is when the parties roll out their commercials for elections. So not like here where you see commercials for months on end. In Israel, it's a week of commercials, and then people go to the ballot box and make that decision. So we're waiting. The prime minister has not made his way to the podium just yet. You have a thought, Geraldo, on what he might say? What are the first words out of the prime minister's mouth? Is he going to say something about the president right away?
I think we have already known, seen a distinction from previous addresses. The biggest, most dramatic difference is usually the president of the Senate, the vice president of the United States, in our case, Joe Biden, would have made the introductory remarks. But Vice President Biden is off, I think, in Guatemala. Is it someplace in Latin America? The president obviously has not met with the Israeli prime minister. So the opening introductory remarks were made by the senior Republican Orrin Hatch, the senator from Utah. So you had Senator Hatch rather than the president of the Senate, the man who presides over the United States Senate in times like this, the vice president of the United States. So you have that distinction. We do have the dean of the diplomatic corps has made his way into the Capitol chamber there. It is an interesting thing. We're seeing now Bibi's wife is in the chamber eagerly awaiting
and
her
husband's
remarks.
And you see who's next
remarks.
To him? Elie Wiesel.
Elie Wiesel, of course.
Is next to Sarah Netanyahu, the prime minister's wife. And that's, of course, Geraldo, against another backdrop of what's happening in Switzerland. As we speak, there are negotiations going on between the U.S., other world nations, and Iran. And we were watching the negotiators from Iran walk out of those meetings, what is this afternoon, Switzerland time. Reporters yelling at them, asking them how the negotiations are going. They said they are still far apart, but they said they were willing to meet with those nations involved in those talks until a deal was hammered out. So they were sounding optimistic in Switzerland, where you can imagine the Secretary of State, John Kerry, is trying to move this deal as fast as possible, worried about what might be said back home by Bibi Netanyahu today.
Just be an off-world observer. This is a very fascinating scenario that is playing out here. You have two realities. The number one reality is there can be no deal with Iran, but with the United States of America being crucially involved. Why? Because of the sanctions that we have imposed on Iran. The hardest hurt is the American aspect of those sanctions. So the United States is a crucial partner in the side that is trying to leverage Iran into making a deal on the nuclear weapons. And the United States is fractured when it comes to this issue, as evidenced by this historic address by the Israeli Prime Minister to the Congress of the United States, an address that we can never forget was absolutely non-traditional in the way it was generated. Usually, when a foreign leader comes to this land, they meet, when you are a prime minister, you meet with the chief executive of our country, the president. That is the co-partner. Prime Minister Netanyahu should have met with the president of the United States. He should indeed have been invited by the president of the United States. It is the executive branch of the American government in our constitutional system that the right wing is constantly saying the president does not honor. Well, under our constitution, it is the executive branch, the president of the United States, who conducts the foreign policy of the United States, prime minister to president. In this case, as you know, the speaker of the House of Representatives, John Boehner, a man who presides over a very fractured caucus within his own party, issued this invitation. Why did he issue the invitation? Was this, and this is a fascinating discussion, I think, if you're talking politics, as we await the historic address by Bibi Netanyahu, whose idea was this? In other words, did Bibi say, I tell you what, I'm going to get a foot up in my election campaign by asking Speaker Boehner to invite me to address the Congress in a stealth, secret way. We'll stick it in Obama's eye. At the same time, I'll get to make a big splash in the Congress of the United States. Or was it the House Republicans who decided to commit this mischievous act and say, we're going to screw the president who is dicking around with this immigration stuff that we don't like and Obamacare that we don't like. We're going to embarrass the president of the United States and use the Israeli prime minister as the instrument to inflict on President Obama this embarrassment. I wonder whose idea, Noam Layden, do you think it was? Was it Boehner's idea or was it Netanyahu's idea? Who is the mischief maker?
Well, you know, my guess is we'll never know the true answer to that question. They are longtime friends. They've known each other for years, Boehner and Bibi Netanyahu. For sure, Boehner has a lot invested in getting Bibi elected to another term in Israel. And at the same time, bringing Bibi Netanyahu over to Congress helps Boehner with the conservative end of his Republican Party. All right, so now Bibi Netanyahu making his way to the podium. We're going to listen. You can hear the applause.
I'm sure there'll be a standing ovation. No one has leapt to their feet. We're watching a video delay. But they're standing. Some empty seats are visible, not a lot. I mean, there are a lot of people in there. You know, you have all, 92 of the 100 senators, I think. So there would be 8 Senate seats empty. Of the 435 members of the House, 50 or so vacant.
The big names not there. Elizabeth Warren, who lots of people, of course, talking about making a presidential run. Al Franken, the Minnesota senator, is not there.
Here he is, Bibi coming in a scene that mimics in some ways the State of the Union, where the senators and congressmen crowd the aisle to get the photo op, shaking the hand of the leader. So Bibi is coming into the chamber now.
I wonder if our congressman got there, you know, hours before.
Oh, so they could, what's his name? Elliot Engel.
Is Elliot Engel, you know, didn't take a pee break for 9 hours, so he could be on the end of the aisle to shake hands.
Bibi being escorted in by Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. It is a sea of old white men, but I do see one Asian woman. I don't know what district she represents. But there's Bibi, another lady. I just see her back as he comes in, crowded. The crowd still cheering him on. Looks sort of like a Kiwanis Club meeting, but here he comes. Bibi running, this would be, how many, is this his third?
This would be a third term.
This would be a third term for Bibi, who represents the Likud party, which I guess if we had, it would be something. I think I find them like the Tea Party in this country. I think that's the easiest comparison.
I don't think they lean that right.
Likud?
Yeah. There's far right-wing parties in
Israel. They're right of center.
Likud is right of center.
And there are some to the right of them.
Oh, much further right.
Much further right. Those are the settler parties and the...
Bunch of religious parties, yeah.
And most of those people come from Brooklyn.
You know, I'm watching Bibi walk through the chamber and shaking the hands of all these lawmakers.
Oh, there's Harry Reid.
It's hard to imagine.
Harry Reid with his patched eye saying that. Yeah.
It's hard to imagine any other world leader getting this kind of reception.
Well, it would depend on timing. For instance, if Hollande of France came in the days after the Charlie Hebdo massacre, I think he would have gotten a similar reaction. But on any ordinary day, no, you're right. They would not get this emotional and fractured a response. Still standing, the ovation now. It's a mansion of West Virginia saying hello. Bibi milking this one. All right, come on, let's get to the podium. Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, set now that the greetings have done. He's shaking hands as if he was running for the Senate of the United States, or even the presidency of the United States. He might have a good shot to get the Republican nomination.
Better
now
shot
I think
here than back home, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe. And Israel was, we told, at least CNN reported this morning, that Israelis are divided. 38 favor his making the speech, 38%, 38% oppose his making the speech. The others not yet decided.
I have the high privilege and distinct honor of presenting to you the Prime Minister of Israel, His Excellency Benjamin Netanyahu.
WABC, here is Bibi. Interrupted by another standing ovation.
Speaker of the House, John Boehner, President Pro Temp, Senator Orrin Hatch, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, and House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy. I also want to acknowledge Senator Democratic Leader Harry Reid. Harry, it's good to see you back on your feet.
Reference to Reed's accident that gave him that patch.
I guess it's true what they say, you can't keep a good man down. My friends, I'm deeply humbled by the opportunity to speak for a third time before the most important legislative body in the world, the U.S. Congress. I want to thank you all for being here today. I know that my speech has been the subject of much controversy. I deeply regret that some perceive my being here as political. That was never my intention. I want to thank you Democrats and Republicans, for your common support for Israel, year after year, decade after decade. I know that no matter on which side of the aisle you sit, you stand with Israel. The remarkable alliance between Israel and the United States has always been above politics. It must always remain above politics. Because America and Israel, we share a common destiny, the destiny of promised lands that cherish freedom and offer hope. Israel is grateful for the support of America's people and of America's presidents, from Harry Truman to Barack Obama. We appreciate all that President Obama has done for Israel. Now, some of that is widely known. Some of that is widely known, like strengthening security cooperation and intelligence sharing, opposing anti-Israeli resolutions at the UN. Some of what the president has done for Israel is less well known. I called him in 2010 when we had the Carmel forest fire, and he immediately agreed to respond to my request for urgent aid. In 2011, we had our embassy in Cairo under siege. And again, he provided vital assistance at the crucial moment. Or his support for more missile interceptors during our operation last summer when we took on Hamas terrorists. In each of those moments, I called the president, and he was there. And some of what the president has done for Israel might never be known, because it touches on some of the most sensitive and strategic issues that arise between an American president and an Israeli prime minister. But I know it, and I will always be grateful to President Obama for that support.
Bibi Netanyahu's live speech before the Congress of the United States praising President Obama. You're listening to 77 WABC.
And Israel is grateful to you, the American Congress, for your support, for supporting us in so many ways, especially in generous military assistance and missile defense, including Iron Dome. Last summer, millions of Israelis were protected from thousands of Hamas rockets because this Capitol Dome helped build our Iron Dome.
This is the buttering up part of the speech. When do we get to the bread?
Thank you, America. Thank you for everything you've done for Israel. My friends, I've come here today because as Prime Minister of Israel, I feel a profound obligation to speak to you about an issue that could well threaten the survival of my country and the future of my people, Iran's quest for nuclear weapons. We're an ancient people. In our nearly 4,000 years of history, many have tried repeatedly to destroy the Jewish people. Tomorrow night, on the Jewish holiday of Purim, we'll read the book of Esther. We'll read of a powerful Persian viceroy named Haman, who plotted to destroy the Jewish people some 2,500 years ago. But a courageous Jewish woman, Queen Esther, exposed the plot and gained for the Jewish people the right to defend themselves against their enemies. The plot was foiled. Our people were saved.
Little Sunday school lesson there.
Today, the Jewish people face another attempt by yet another Persian potentate to destroy us. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, spews the oldest hatred of anti-Semitism with the newest technology. He tweets that Israel must be annihilated. He tweets. You know, in Iran, there isn't exactly free internet. But he tweets in English that Israel must be destroyed. For those who believe that Iran threatens the Jewish state, but not the Jewish people, listen to Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, Iran's chief terrorist proxy. He said, "If all the Jews gather in Israel, it will save us the trouble of chasing them down around the world." But Iran's regime is not merely a Jewish problem, any more than the Nazi regime was merely a Jewish problem. The 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis were but a fraction of the 60 million people killed in World War II. So too, Iran's regime poses a grave threat not only to Israel, but also to the peace of the entire world. To understand just how dangerous Iran would be with nuclear weapons, we must fully understand the nature of the regime. The people of Iran are very talented people. They're heirs to one of the world's great civilizations. But in 1979, they were hijacked by religious zealots who imposed on them immediately a dark and brutal dictatorship. That year, the zealots drafted a constitution, a new one for Iran. It directed the Revolutionary Guards not only to protect Iran's borders, but also to fulfill the ideological mission of jihad. The regime's founder, Ayatollah Khomeini, exhorted his followers to export the revolution throughout the world. I'm standing here in Washington, D.C., and the difference is so stark. America's founding document promises life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Iran's founding document pledges death, tyranny, and the pursuit of jihad. And as states are collapsing across the Middle East, Iran is charging into the void to do just that. Iran's goons in Gaza, its lackeys in Lebanon, its revolutionary guards on the Golan Heights are clutching Israel with three tentacles of terror. Backed by Iran, Assad is slaughtering Syrians. Backed by Iran, Shiite militias are rampaging through Iraq. Backed by Iran, Houthis are seizing control of Yemen, threatening the strategic straits at the mouth of the Red Sea. Along with the Straits of Hormuz, that would give Iran a second choke point on the world's oil supply. Just last week, near Hormuz, Iran carried out a military exercise blowing up a mock U.S. aircraft carrier. That's just last week, while they're having nuclear talks with the United States. But unfortunately, for the last 36 years, Iran's attacks against the United States have been anything but mock, and the targets have been all too real. Iran took dozens of Americans hostage in Tehran, murdered hundreds of American soldiers, Marines, in Beirut, and was responsible for killing and maiming thousands of American servicemen and women in Iraq and Afghanistan. Beyond the Middle East, Iran attacks America and its allies through its global terror network. It blew up the Jewish Community Center and the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires. It helped al-Qaeda bomb U.S. embassies in Africa. It even attempted to assassinate the Saudi ambassador right here in Washington, D.C. In the Middle East, Iran now dominates four Arab capitals, Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut, and Sana'a. And if Iran's aggression is left unchecked, more will surely follow. So at a time when many hope that Iran will join the community of nations, Iran is busy gobbling up the nations.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, you're listening to 77 WABC. Live speech.
We must all stand together to stop Iran's march of conquest, subjugation, and terror. Now, 2 years ago, we were told to give President Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif a chance to bring change and moderation to Iran. Some change, some moderation. Rouhani's government hangs gays, persecutes Christians, jails journalists, and executes even more prisoners than before. Last year, the same Zarif, who charms Western diplomats, laid a wreath at the grave of Imad Mournia. Imad Mournia is the terrorist mastermind who spilled more American blood than any other terrorist besides Osama bin Laden. I'd like to see someone ask him a question about that. Iran's regime is as radical as ever. Its cries of death to America, that same America that it calls the Great Satan, as loud as ever. Now, this shouldn't be surprising, because the ideology of Iran's revolutionary regime is deeply rooted in militant Islam. And that's why this regime will always be an enemy of America. And don't be fooled. The battle between Iran and ISIS doesn't turn Iran into a friend of America. Iran and ISIS are competing for the crown of militant Islam. One calls itself the Islamic Republic. The other calls itself the Islamic State. Both want to impose a militant Islamic empire, first on the region and then on the entire world. They just disagree among themselves who will be the ruler of that empire. In this deadly Game of Thrones, there's no place for America or for Israel, no peace for Christians, Jews, or Muslims who don't share the Islamist medieval creed. No rights for women, no freedom for anyone. So when it comes to Iran and ISIS, the enemy of your enemy is your enemy.
You're listening to 77 WABC. Bibi Netanyahu's speech. We'll have analysis when he's finished.
The difference is that ISIS is armed with butcher knives, captured weapons, and YouTube, whereas Iran could soon be armed with intercontinental ballistic missiles and nuclear bombs. We must always remember, I'll say it one more time, the greatest danger facing our world is the marriage of militant Islam with nuclear weapons. To defeat ISIS and let Iran get nuclear weapons would be to win the battle, but lose the war. We can't let that happen.
He has not yet addressed the negotiations on the main issue.
But that, my friends, is exactly what could happen if the deal now being negotiated is accepted by Iran.
Here we go.
That deal will not prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. it would all but guarantee that Iran gets those weapons, lots of them. Let me explain why. While the final deal has not yet been signed, certain elements of any potential deal are now a matter of public record. You don't need intelligence agencies and secret information to know this. You can Google it. Absent a dramatic change, we know for sure that any deal with Iran will include two major concessions to Iran. The first major concession would leave Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure, providing it with a short breakout time to the bomb. Breakout time is the time it takes to amass enough weapons-grade uranium or plutonium for a nuclear bomb. According to the deal, not a single nuclear facility would be demolished. Thousands of centrifuges used to enrich uranium would be left spinning. Thousands more would be temporarily disconnected, but not destroyed. Because Iran's nuclear program would be left largely intact, Iran's breakout time would be very short, about a year by U.S. assessment, even shorter by Israel. And if Iran's work on advanced centrifuges, faster and faster centrifuges, is not stopped, that breakout time could still be shorter, a lot shorter. True, certain restrictions would be imposed on Iran's nuclear program, and Iran's adherence to those restrictions would be supervised by international inspectors. But here's the problem. You see, inspectors document violations. They don't stop them. Inspectors knew when North Korea broke to the bomb, but that didn't stop anything. North Korea turned off the cameras, kicked out the inspectors. Within a few years, it got the bomb. Now we're warned that within 5 years, North Korea could have an arsenal of 100 nuclear bombs. Like North Korea, Iran too has defied international inspectors. It's done that on at least three separate occasions, 2005, 2006, 2010. Like North Korea, Iran broke the locks, shut off the cameras. Now, I know this is not going to come as a shock to any of you, but Iran not only defies inspectors, it also plays a pretty good game of hide and cheat with them. The UN's nuclear watchdog agency, the IAEA, said again yesterday that Iran still refuses to come clean about its military nuclear program. Iran was also caught twice, not once, twice, operating secret nuclear facilities in Natanz and Qom, facilities that inspectors didn't even know existed. Right now, Iran could be hiding nuclear facilities that we don't know about, the U.S. and Israel. As the former head of inspections for the IAEA said in 2013, he said, if there's no undeclared installation today in Iran, it'll be the first time in 20 years that it doesn't have one. Iran has proven time and again that it cannot be trusted. And that's why the first major concession is a source of grave concern. It leaves Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure and relies on inspectors to prevent a breakout. That concession creates a real danger that Iran could get to the bomb by violating the deal. But the second major concession creates an even greater danger that Iran could get to the bomb by keeping the deal. Because virtually all the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program will automatically expire in about a decade. Now, a decade may seem like a long time in political life, but it's the blink of an eye in the life of a nation. It's a blink of an eye in the life of our children. We all have a responsibility to consider what will happen when Iran's nuclear capabilities are virtually unrestricted and all the sanctions will have been lifted. Iran would then be free to build a huge nuclear capacity that could produce many, many nuclear bombs. Iran's supreme leader says that openly. He says Iran plans to have 190,000 centrifuges, not 6,000 or even the 19,000 that Iran has today, but 10 times that amount, 190,000 centrifuges enriching uranium. With this massive capacity, Iran could make the fuel for an entire nuclear arsenal, and this in a matter of weeks, once it makes that decision. My longtime friend, John Kerry, Secretary of State, confirmed last week that Iran could legitimately possess that massive centrifuge capacity when the deal expires. Now, I want you to think about that. The foremost sponsor of global terrorism could be weeks away from having enough enriched uranium for an entire arsenal of nuclear weapons, and this with full international legitimacy. And by the way, if Iran's intercontinental ballistic missile program is not part of the deal, and so far Iran refuses to even put it on the negotiating table, while Iran could have the means to deliver that nuclear arsenal to the far reach corners of the earth, including to every part of the United States. So you see, my friends, this deal has two major concessions. One, leaving Iran with a vast nuclear program. And two, lifting the restrictions on that program in about a decade. That's why this deal is so bad. It doesn't block Iran's path to the bomb. It paves Iran's path to the bomb. So why would anyone make this deal? Because they hope that Iran will change for the better in the coming years? Or they believe that the alternative to this deal is worse? Well, I disagree. I don't believe that Iran's radical regime will change for the better after this deal. This regime has been in power for 36 years, and its voracious appetite for aggression grows with each passing year. This deal would only whet Iran's appetite for more. Would Iran be less aggressive when sanctions are removed and its economy is stronger? If Iran is gobbling up four countries right now while it's under sanctions, how many more countries will Iran devour when sanctions are lifted? Would Iran fund less terrorism when it has mountains of cash with which to fund more terrorism? Why should Iran's radical regime change for the better when it can enjoy the best of both worlds, aggression abroad, prosperity at home? This is a question that everyone asks in our region. Israel's neighbors, Iran's neighbors, know that Iran will become even more aggressive and sponsor even more terrorism when its economy is unshackled and it's been given a clear path to the bomb. And many of these neighbors say they'll respond by racing to get nuclear weapons of their own. So this deal won't change Iran for the better. It will only change the Middle East for the worse. A deal that's supposed to prevent nuclear proliferation would instead spark a nuclear arms race in the most dangerous part of the planet. This deal won't be a farewell to arms. It would be a farewell to arms control. And the Middle East would soon be crisscrossed by nuclear tripwires. A region where small skirmishes can trigger big wars would turn into a nuclear tinderbox. If anyone thinks this deal kicks the can down the road, think again. When we get down that road, we'll face a much more dangerous Iran, a Middle East littered with nuclear bombs, and a countdown to a potential nuclear nightmare. Ladies and gentlemen, I've come here today to tell you we don't have to bet the security of the world on the hope that Iran will change for the better. We don't have to gamble with our future and with our children's future. We can insist that restrictions on Iran's nuclear program not be lifted for as long as Iran continues its aggression in the region and in the world.
All right, Bibi Netanyahu, his speech on 77 WABC. I'm going to let him wrap it up, followed by our analysis. He seems to be getting toward his conclusion now.
Before lifting those restrictions, the world should demand that Iran do three things. First, stop its aggression against its neighbors in the Middle East. Second, stop supporting terrorism around the world. And third, stop threatening to annihilate my country, Israel, the one and only Jewish state. If the world powers are not prepared to insist that Iran change its behavior before a deal is signed, at the very least, they should insist that Iran change its behavior before a deal expires. If Iran changes its behavior, the restrictions would be lifted. If Iran doesn't change its behavior, the restrictions should not be lifted. If Iran wants to be treated like a normal country, let it act like a normal country.
The Israeli Prime Minister savoring the moment. Dramatic pauses for applause.
My friends, what about the argument that there is no alternative to this deal? That Iran's nuclear know-how cannot be erased, that its nuclear program is so advanced that the best we can do is delay the inevitable, which is essentially what the proposed deal seeks to do. Well, nuclear know-how without nuclear infrastructure doesn't get you very much. A race car driver without a car can't drive. A pilot without a plane can't fly. Without thousands of centrifuges, tons of enriched uranium, or heavy water facilities, Iran can't make nuclear weapons.
Dow is down 131. Wall Street not liking what
it hears. Iran's nuclear program can be rolled back well beyond the current proposal by insisting on a better deal and keeping up the pressure on a very vulnerable regime, especially given the recent collapse in the price of oil. Now, if Iran threatens to walk away from the table, and this often happens in a Persian bazaar, call their bluff. They'll be back because they need the deal a lot more than you do. And by maintaining the pressure on Iran and on those who do business with Iran, you have the power to make them need it even more. My friends, for over a year, we've been told that no deal is better than a bad deal. Well, this is a bad deal. It's a very bad deal. We're better off without it.
There were a million places there he could have ended this this speech. Now 40 minutes long. No deal better than a bad deal.
Now we're being told that the only alternative to this bad deal is war. That's just not true. The alternative to this bad deal is a much better deal.
On the Democratic side, many people sitting on their hands, not joining in the applause. Definitely a partisan response to this speech so far in Congress. Dow down 144.
A better deal that doesn't leave Iran with a vast nuclear infrastructure in such a short breakout time. A better deal that keeps the restrictions on Iran's nuclear program in place until Iran's aggression ends. A better deal that won't give Iran an easy path to the bomb. A better deal that Israel and its neighbors may not like, but with which we could live, literally. And no country has a greater stake. No country has a greater stake than Israel in a good deal that peacefully removes this threat. Ladies and gentlemen, history has placed us at a fateful crossroads. We must now choose between two paths. One path leads to a bad deal that will at best curtail Iran's nuclear ambitions for a while, but it will inexorably lead to a nuclear-armed Iran whose unbridled aggression will inevitably lead to war. The second path, however difficult, could lead to a much better deal that would prevent a nuclear-armed Iran, a nuclearized Middle East, and the horrific consequences of both to all of humanity. You don't have to read Robert Frost to know. You have to live life to know that the difficult path is usually the one less traveled. But it will make all the difference for the future of my country, the security of the Middle East, and the peace of the world, the peace we all desire.
Bibi Netanyahu, I think, wrapping up his speech, urging the United States and the other nations to hold out for a better deal with Iran.
My friend, standing up to Iran is not easy. Standing up to dark and murderous regimes never is. With us today is Holocaust survivor and Nobel Prize winner Elie Wiesel.
Invoking the Holocaust. You know how I feel about that. Alan Dershowitz is there. Isn't that Dershowitz?
Yeah, that's definitely Dershowitz.
Elie, your life and work inspire us to give meaning to the words, never again. And I wish I could promise you, Elie, that the lessons of history have been learned. I can only urge the leaders of the world not to repeat the mistakes of the past. Not to sacrifice the future for the present. Not to ignore aggression in the hopes of gaining an illusory peace. But I can guarantee you this. The days when the Jewish people remain passive in the face of genocidal enemies, those days are over.
Is that an implied threat that Israel will take unilateral military action if these negotiations proceed? I hope that he'll sum up now.
We are no longer scattered among the nations, powerless to defend ourselves. We've restored our sovereignty in our ancient home, and the soldiers who defend our home have boundless courage. For the first time in 100 generations, we, the Jewish people, can defend ourselves.
Doesn't that sound like a unilateral threat of military action? I'm being told I have to take a break, but I want to hear the concluding remarks.
This is why, as Prime Minister of Israel, I can promise you one more thing. Even if Israel has to stand alone, Israel will stand.
Yes, it was an implied and very explicit there, not implied, an explicit threat that Israel will take military action if necessary.
But I know that Israel does not stand alone. I know that America stands with Israel. I know that you stand with Israel.
Half the chamber on its feet, the other half still sitting. It's 11:48. You listen to 77 WABC. Bibi Netanyahu's remarks, hopefully concluding any moment.
You stand with Israel because you know that the story of Israel is not only the story of the Jewish people, but of the human spirit that refuses again and again to succumb to history's horrors.
Drawing that connection between Iran and Hitler.
Facing me, right up there in the gallery. Overlooking all of us in this august chamber is the image of Moses. Moses led our people from slavery to the gates of the Promised Land. And before the people of Israel entered the land of Israel, Moses gave us a message that has steeled our resolve for thousands of years. I leave you with his message today. Chizku v'imtzu. Be strong and resolute, neither fear nor dread them. My friends, may Israel and America always stand together, strong and resolute. May we neither fear nor dread the challenges ahead. May we face the future with confidence, strength, and hope. May God bless the state of Israel, and may God bless the United States of America.
Bibi Netanyahu concluding his remarks, a stirring speech.